The other day, my son told me about a course he's taking in college for credit on mindfulness and stress reduction. And I don't think he was quite aware of the irony of being the son of the author of the book What's Wrong with Mindfulness, taking this course. But I had a chance to hear him sort of describe what the experience was, and he said that initially the instructor filled the entire time with a guided meditation. So there's almost no silence at all while she sort of spoke and tried to set a certain tone of awareness, right? And he and a couple of the other people in the class got annoyed at all that talking, and they asked if they could just sit in silence. And she agreed. So he said the last few times they've just been sitting in silence for 45 minutes or an hour. And he said, you know, that's hard. I said, I did have some experience with that. It was indeed hard. He, from a very early age, he's had no trouble sitting in lotus position, half or full lotus. He doesn't feel physical pain, but he says the hard part is just being with your mind during all that silence. So one way or another, he's getting the idea. So it got me thinking about how we instruct beginners, and what the initial introduction to meditation does or doesn't do for people. You know, in his case, I'm willing to say, all right, maybe it'll serve as a gateway drug and he'll get drawn into Zazen at some point. On the other hand, you know, many people say that your initial experience of meditation and your initial experience of a teacher really shapes your whole attitude towards it for years and years to come. There it's sort of on the analogy of learning a golf swing or a tennis stroke, that if you start out doing some quirky, idiosyncratic thing that sort of works for you when you're a kid, later on, if you really try to master the stroke, you have a lot of trouble undoing what has become second nature for you. And certainly there are many things about my initial exposure to Zen that stayed with me, often traumatically, from that initial sense of Zazen being about endurance. And that no matter what was going on in your mind was nothing compared to what was going on in your knees, you know, and that Zazen was first and foremost a kind of physical practice. And Joko, you know, to a large extent, tried to shift the emphasis to the psychology of practice, away from the pure physicality of the form. But she was no slouch in the pain department. in general, she did not, to me anyway, talk much about posture or form, but she talked all the time about sitting still, don't move. And that she would sort of say, if you're just starting out, if you're a beginner and you're really in a lot of pain, okay, you move, adjust your posture, or if you have to, sit in a chair. But if you've been sitting for a while, or if you know, or, and you're not young, by which she meant probably under 60, since she started late in life, if it hurts, the practice is let it hurt. For her, and I think that generation I grew up with, Zazen was about non-avoidance, about staying with something you would otherwise turn away from. And that physical difficulty, physical pain, was the correlate of staying with emotional pain. And if you could train yourself to sit still in physical pain, maybe when you got hurt or angry or reactive, you could just stay with that and learn something about it instead of immediately having some reactive language or motion or gesture, right? Now, over the years, I think our emphasis generally has shifted away from that model, and there's much less emphasis on staying with physical pain. But it, while I don't think practice should be about endurance, it should be about non-avoidance. It should be about staying and doing something difficult, even if that only means showing up to the zendo or to your cushion regularly, whether you feel like it or not. Just going against the resistance of, I don't want to tonight. Just do it anyway. Just show up. Just feel what it's like to be there when you don't want to be there. Right? Let that be the experience of Zazen. Now, over the years, I've sort of talked about beginning practice in two kinds of ways. One is that everybody comes to practice for the wrong reason. And the second, you can't do it wrong. And it's interesting sometimes to think about how the two of those would relate to each other, or if I'm just contradicting myself. Not impossible. That everybody comes for the wrong reason basically refers to the idea that we can't help but come to Zazen with a variety of gaining ideas and projects. We can't help come to it seeing it as a technique we're trying to master and that we feel we're doing well or badly. That whole mindset infuses almost everything we do in our life, and we inevitably will bring it to our practice. The point, though, is that practice in some way is supposed to be a grindstone for that, that it's an attempt to make explicit that kind of gaining idea and gradually wear it out, or at least gradually start creating some idea of an alternative of what it would be like not to sit that way, not to live that way. And there's sort of, in different traditions, different degrees of sort of trusting the practice of sitting itself to do that sort of semi-automatically. There's the old story of a monk in Buddha's time, of a man who got completely drunk one night, and in the middle of being drunk decided, he wanted to be a monk, and showed up at the temple, dead drunk, but woke up the next morning with a shaved head wearing robes, right? And some of the monks went to Buddha and said, this can't be legitimate. This guy had no idea what he was asking for or choosing. Throw him out of here. And Buddha said, no, one way or another, his karma brought him to this place. And that even if he came to do it for all sorts of wrong reasons, being a monk itself will be the cure for those wrong reasons, right? And in Dogen, you get some sense that Zazen itself, almost whether we like it or not, is going to embody our true nature. It may take us a very long time to recognize that that's what's already been happening, but it's sort of, in a certain sense, goes on with us or without us, right? That's one sense of the you can't do it wrong, right? The other sense is that from the perspective of Zazen not being a technique, of where it's something like looking in a mirror, everything is just automatically displaying itself. You're here just to show up and see what appears. And part of what you're there to observe is all your wrong reasons for being here, right? They're going to be perfectly displayed to you. So it's not a problem that you've come for the wrong reasons. The whole way this is set up is so that those wrong reasons will be eventually made explicit, brought out into the open, and worked through. Now, I think for most of us, our experience is that Zazen won't really do that automatically on its own, that it's part of the role of the teacher to try to articulate some of those wrong reasons, help you sort of make yourself conscious of your agenda. It's what I, when newcomers show up, my basic question to them is, what are you doing here? Right? And I always mean it in the two-edged sense of, what are you trying to do on the cushion? What is your practice? Are you counting breath, or what? What are you doing there? But also in the bigger sense of, what brings you to do a thing like this at all? Right? What about yourself is so uncomfortable that you need to do this drastic thing to try to come to terms with it? Or what fantasy or ideal or dream are you chasing that you think this is going to help you achieve? And everybody's got some version of these things, and we all have to sit with them for many, many years until we really get some sense of there being an alternative to that. The alternative, if it appears suddenly, you call it Kensho. But sometimes that alternative just emerges very, very gradually as you wear out all the ideas you have about what you think this is and where you think it's taking you. And Joko basically talked about that in terms of giving up all hope. right? That in hopelessness, you finally can emerge in a place where there's no gaining idea. You've given it up. It's just the whole project is sort of turned to ashes in your mouth. And just when you think the whole thing is a failure, that's when there's a possibility of something else emerging. In that sense, it's why I've actually often preferred to be the second teacher that people have. See, on one model, you want to be there, the first teacher, and show them the right way to do this from the beginning. You know, teach them the right way to hold the racket in the right form to, from the get-go, so that in the beginning you establish good habits and good posture and discipline and all those things. But actually, I find it in some way easier to be the second teacher when somebody shows up after the first go at this has failed one way or another, right? That's when people are really able to think about what is this, what was I trying to do, and what went wrong, right? Did they get disappointed in themselves? Did they think of themselves as a failure? Did they get disappointed in the teacher? Were they, did the teacher suddenly behave in a way that was incompatible with their idea of what a teacher should be like? Joko's place was just filled with exiles, right? In a way, nobody ever taught beginning anything because everybody had been doing it for 10 or 20 years and was there as their last alternative before they just threw in the towel and gave the whole thing up. And so it was an enormously challenging environment because people, in a sense, took it very seriously as this is sort of our last chance. So the people gathered here are always an odd mix of those different stories and agendas. And there's no one way that I think everybody needs to be treated. But I do think that we all need at every stage of our practice to just stay with that question of what am I doing here? Watch carefully what we expect. I have tried over the years to articulate something of what I call a post-enlightenment practice, a practice that just manifests being here as the expression of who and what we are, just being ourselves, not trying to make anything happen whatsoever. You know, that's sort of the idea. If it's post-enlightenment, you sort of got it, you made it. Well, now what? What do you think that's going to be like? And why would you keep practicing afterwards? This is sort of the trying to think of a practice that just unfolds along with the rest of our life as part of the rest of our life. Just being here, being yourself, seeing if you can honestly face your mind and your body just as they are. Moment after moment, being able to say, this is me, this is me, this is me, and see what that is.